I want, on behalf of the two organizations mentioned, to welcome all of you here tonight and to participate in this perhaps significant gathering. As you know, the purpose of this meeting, jointly sponsored by the Minnesota branch of the American Civil Liberties Union and the Minnesota Conference of the American Association of University Professors, was called to focus attention on academic freedom and responsibility, a subject very much in need of explanation and one of vital concern to the public, which ultimately profits most from academic freedom. It is our good fortune to have as speakers this evening three men vitally and equally concerned with the subject before us, also strategically situated to consider the topic from somewhat different points of view. Dr. Kahn, from that of a member of a college governing board, Father Shannon, from that of a college president, and Professor Mocklip, from that of a university professor. I shall call on the speakers in the order just given. And at the conclusion of the third and final address, we will have the usual question and answer period. I want to take this opportunity to thank in advance all those who planned and arranged this gathering, and especially our speakers who have given of their time, energy, and great wisdom. Our first speaker tonight, the Reverend Howard J. Kahn, as most of you, I think, know, is the minister of the Plymouth Congregational Church in Minneapolis. He is also a member of the Board of Trustees of Carleton College. Furthermore, he too is a director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Minnesota branch. I could tell you quite a bit about Dr. Kahn. In the interest of brevity, I shall limit my comments to just a couple. Educated at, that is, receiving his BA degree from Stanford University. He pursued graduate study at Harvard University, received his Bachelor of Divinity degree from the Yale Divinity School, held pastorates in both Massachusetts and Connecticut, before coming to Minneapolis in 1944. He's the author of many articles. He has been active, as you know, in civic affairs. He is articulate, alert, informed. Dr. Kahn, who will speak from the vantage point of the trustee. Dr. Kahn.
The distinguished anthropologist, Lauren Isley, helps us get perspective on man's long quest for truth as he writes imaginatively of the caravan of human existence that extends far back into the geological ages. Down how many roads among the stars must man propel himself in search of the final secret? The journey is difficult, immense, at times impossible, yet that will not deter some of us from attempting it. We cannot know all that has happened in the past any more than we can with surety discern what lies ahead. We have joined the caravan, you might say, at a certain point. We will travel as far as we can, but we cannot in one lifetime see all that we would like to see or learn all that we hunger to know. I choose to begin with this reminder of the immense journey of human development because the trustee of any college must view his responsibility as related to this caravan as it moves forward in the quest for truth. In our contemporary society, trustees of public and private institutions of higher learning tend to be selected because of their success in the world of politics, industry, commerce, and the professions. They are men and women of skills who have demonstrated the ability to handle productively one or more areas of practical concern. The initial impression, therefore, may be that to suppose that these persons are chosen to run the colleges in a manner similar to the effectiveness with which they have managed their own personal affairs. But I'm sure we will all agree that this impression is misleading. Actually, the trustees do not manage the colleges. More accurately, they may be described as boards of overseers, representing society's stake in the safety and integrity of the caravan of human development as it moves through particular institutions in a given generation. The trustees know many excitements in the political arena and the marketplace where they customarily operate, but they do not transfer their involvements in these issues directly to the conduct of the college. For example, a businessman has a vital interest in tax legislation voted by Congress. But his function of a college trustee is not to influence the academic community to adopt his view on this or any other topic. His responsibility, rather, is to provide the setting for the unhampered search for truth and meaning of life by scholars who explore new horizons and excite young people with the thrill of the quest. Like everyone involved in the college community, he is committed to freedom in providing what Justice Learned Hand called a fair field and an honest race to all ideas. Thus, we may say that the first and foremost function of a trustee is to serve as a custodian for the public welfare in providing the finest possible institutions of higher learning. He gives of his wisdom, resources, and influence that this country may have colleges and universities dedicated to the training of American youth in the finest traditions of sound learning and ethical insights. These traditions cherish the freedom to explore and to pursue truth wherever it may lead, in the confidence that only through such freedom can the caravan move forward. The first function of trustees is to determine the policies of the institution, but in most colleges, the policies are broadly consistent with the traditions of freedom and responsibility in our Western society. A second function is to select a president with capacity to choose a faculty and administer the institution. Matters of detail and administration are therefore given to the president, and wise trustees do not seek to interfere with his authority to lead the college within its general aims. A third function is to assist the president in any counsel he may request and to help him carry out his program. A large part of this task, of course, is to provide the finances and the plant for operations. A clear demarcation of responsibilities helps to safeguard academic freedom because public pressures on college trustees or university regents often result from an inadequate concept of the proper role of the various parties on the campus scene. Let me now mention three specific problems which may clarify the role of freedom and responsibility within an academic situation. What if a trustee disagrees with a professor and his teachings? Rarely ought this constitute any problem at all. A trustee's function is neither to perpetuate or oppose Wordsworth's theory of poetry or de Tocqueville's views of American democracy. He should be content to set the stage in which the academic community of scholars and students can examine with complete freedom all the great ideas that have been involved in man's quest for truth and significance. In the college where I serve, a quaint and increasingly cumbersome custom once a year is for the entire faculty to pass through a receiving line to shake hands with all the trustees. One October, most of the faculty ran the gauntlet wearing Stevenson buttons, in approximately the inverse ratio of trustee preference for the same candidate. Now, no one took offense, but both sides of the handshakers registered amusement. The only noticeable effect of this faculty display of independent judgment was that the whole idea of the receiving line was abandoned the next year. But I take it that this was a social gain for both sides. Sometimes we hear the complaint that universities are corrupting youth because they're giving them ideas different from those of the community. This complaint, of course, is as old as the time of Socrates, because the purpose of education is to enlarge understanding. Inevitably, the educational circles will be in advance of the general public. If parents do not want their young people to get new ideas, they can try to keep them home and to lock them in closets. But if they wish them educated, they must expect them to return with newer concepts and differing ideas. Do trustees have a right at any time to intervene in the teaching rights of faculty members? I hope all of us will agree that a justifiable situation is hard to imagine, but I would suppose that the trustees might have such a right if they had evidence to suggest that a faculty member was committed to a political organization or foreign government in such a manner that he was not free to express truth according to the integrity of a scholar. The educational process is predicated on the assumption that man is free to pursue the truth wherever it leads, and the trustees will not interfere unless there is evidence that the scholars themselves have abandoned this freedom. This leads then to a second problem, the responsibility of scholars. Innumerable times it has been observed that freedom and responsibility are two sides of the same coin. The intellectual search for truth and the religious quest for meaning are predicated on the assumption that man lives in an intelligible world. He is part of an orderliness in which patterns can be discerned and purposes pursued. His dignity is achieved as he, the thinking part of the created order, can bring within human scope knowledge of the past, control of environment, and appreciations that ennoble. The pivotal role of freedom in the pursuit of education is described by Scripture. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. We must be free from all restraints if we are to learn, and the insights which our learning bring add to our liberation. Teachers are granted freedom to expose students to ideas of all sorts, but the ideas will correct themselves as they compete for acceptance. A professor should be modest about advocating an idea which scarcely commends itself to careful thinkers. Men differ in attitudes and tastes so that the academic community is not reduced to a stodgy uniformity. There will be lively discussions amongst individuals and between disciplines, but the participants in such discussions have the responsibility to keep regard for the truth uppermost and to advocate such positions as reasonable and conscientious men can embrace without apology. Out of honest inquiry, mutual sharing, and the testing of one idea by another, the pursuit of truth can go on as an exciting adventure, drawing forth the best in men and giving the world the best that human endeavor can discern. A third problem that needs to be mentioned is a difference between public and private colleges. The regents of a state university are the custodians of the concern for higher education on the part of the citizenry. They can show no partiality amongst the various groups in society. On the other hand, many of our private colleges were founded by religious bodies and can properly be expected to maintain the bias of these bodies. As church-related colleges have matured, they have demonstrated the same regard for academic freedom as other universities. Their faculties are selected for competence in particular areas and are expected to have the same devotion to truth. We cannot conceive of a church-related college asking its professors to alter their teachings or color their presentations to conform with the theological viewpoint of the church body. Yet such colleges may select their faculties with a view to building a community of scholars in which a general attitude of religious sensitivity may prevail. This can be done without infringement of academic freedom if the integrity of each professor is respected, for the religious orientation is accepted by a sizable proportion of people in every walk of life, academic or otherwise. In the case of private colleges, academic freedom is not necessarily impaired if the trustees seek to foster the ideals and perspective to which the college is dedicated. But confusion at this point easily arises. When I spoke this winter at a convocation of our college, a student said to me, "Sir, I am pleased to note that you are a director of the Civil Liberties Union, but I must say that I find this inconsistent with your position as a trustee who requires attendance at chapel." Those who choose to be a part of the community of a church-related college, either as students or faculty, know in advance the atmosphere which they enter and can expect that the institution will stress certain values. Yet no compromise with academic freedom should be indulged, for religious values are themselves a part of the universal system of truth which can be embraced only in freedom. Truth of every kind eludes those who would coerce it. The trustees, then, are partners with students, faculty, and administration in the search for wisdom. They are the least active of the participants, but they appreciate the opportunity to assist in some way the caravan of mankind on the immense journey toward wisdom and understanding.
Our next speaker will be the Reverend Monsignor James P. Shannon, President of the College of St. Thomas.
Thank you, Dr. Bjork. I have chosen, ladies and gentlemen, to use my time as economically as possible and to go rapidly from one topic to another, the topics which I think are of crucial significance in this large discussion of academic freedom, in the hope that we might use our time economically and that I might give you a fix on my position on these questions and give you the opportunity to present questions to me at the end of the allotted time for the speakers here. So if you will permit me the opportunity to move quickly from one question to another, I would appreciate it. I shall try in my presentation to distinguish between the realm of demonstrable fact and that other large undiscovered land which is known as Father Shannon's opinions. This has not yet been charted by any visiting cartographer. And I shall start by giving some of my opinions in this realm of academic freedom. It is my opinion, ladies and gentlemen, that the president of a college, whether he be the president of a private college such as the College of St. Thomas or McAllister College or the University of Minnesota, a public institution, is seriously responsible in the eyes of the public, in the eyes of his own faculty, and in the eyes of God, to defend the right of his faculty to pursue truth in their respective disciplines. Many of you have already read the published statements of the American Association of University Professors on the large question of academic freedom, and you will note that in those statements, the rights and the freedoms of professors are restricted by this statement, in their respective disciplines. This association is careful to emphasize the importance of a man's being protected in his right to pursue truth in his own discipline. It is my opinion that academic freedom is merely an extension for the academic person, for the professor, for the professional researcher or scholar or student, merely an extension of his individual right of freedom of speech in our free society. But that because he is what you might call a professional searcher after truth, he deserves a special status in society and deserves particular protection because he is professionally concerned in dealing with ideas. And it is a fundamental responsibility of his president and his administration to protect him in these basic rights of his profession. These are essential. These are fundamental to the work to which he is dedicated in his lifetime pursuit of truth. There is a corresponding responsibility which the administration and which the president have, and that is to explain the faculty and to make the faculty understood by that larger series of publics which make up the constituencies of the college. The president, in a certain sense, is answerable to two different publics, primarily the public of his own faculty, and secondarily the public of these other constituencies. But I state categorically that his fundamental responsibility is to his faculty. The primary bond of loyalty which a college president has is to his faculty. If he is faithful to them, they will be faithful in discharging their responsibilities to their students. And the students and the faculty, in turn, will be faithful in discharging the responsibilities of that college to the larger public. But nonetheless, the president, living as he does between the faculty and the larger public of the several different constituencies, must make a conscientious effort to explain his faculty to the other publics and to explain the other publics to his faculty. I should also like to state categorically that I believe a professor who has the advantages of the protection of academic freedom in one of our colleges should recognize that he has a freedom to pursue his discipline, to state the dictates of his own conscience, and to seek truth as he sees it, but that he also is responsible for the good name of the institution which he represents. This is another way of saying that the freedom enjoyed by a professor on any faculty is not an absolute freedom. It is a freedom which is qualified by his position on a faculty of his peers and in an institution which has a right in charity and in justice to its own good name. Therefore, a professor who chooses to exercise his academic freedom by seeming to espouse publicly tenets or positions which in his own heart he does not really endorse is abusing his freedom and is asking of the administration of his college a defense of him and a protection of him which he does not really deserve under these circumstances. It is one thing, ladies and gentlemen, for the administration of a university or a college to spend itself to protect its faculty in that faculty's earnest search for truth in its own disciplines. It is another thing for a university administration to be expected by a member of its faculty to defend that member in public statements which in his heart he does not seriously and truly espouse. This, I think, is asking more of the administration than the administration is responsible under God and in justice to deliver. I said at the beginning of my remarks that I would skip from topic to topic, and I apologize for this, but I think it's the most economic use of my time. I would hope that our discussion tonight could avoid the personality cult of the Sibley-Rosen debate. It may be that either Dr. Sibley or Mr. Rosen is here. If they are, I'd like to meet them after the meeting. But I would hope that our discussion tonight would talk about the issues of academic freedom and not about the personality cult that has arisen between these two men. It happens to be my opinion that in their public debate, Mr. Rosen won with his constituents and Mr. Sibley won with his constituents, and the only one who lost is the University of Minnesota. It is my opinion that the University of Minnesota is a first-rate academic institution with a very good faculty and with an excellent administration. And I think its good name has been hurt, I hope not irreparably, in this debate. And I would hope that my remarks and the remarks of the other professors on the panel this evening would be construed as comments on the general topic and not on the specific topic of the recent controversy at the University of Minnesota. In the nature of things, ladies and gentlemen, a college or a university is the scene where new ideas are expected and proposed and challenged and tested and accepted or rejected. In any society, in any age, there is a very strong temptation or inclination to maintain one's identity with the status quo, with the method that has been used in the past. In every society, there is a natural and expected resistance to new ideas. But the specific function of a professor in a college or a university is to propose new ideas and to match them against the ideas of his confreres, to test their validity, to accept them or to reject them. And we who are engaged in administering the affairs of colleges should recognize this as one of our primary functions, the generation of and the testing of new ideas. And we should be prepared for the consequences in a society which, in any society, which tends to resist new ideas. And we who are the administrators of these colleges should recognize our serious responsibility to our faculties to protect them in this exercise of their legitimate, pristine function as the originators of new ideas and new concepts. And we should recognize also that it is not only our responsibility to defend our faculty members in their espousal of new concepts, but that we are also, in a very special sense, the conservators, the defenders, the protectors of a tradition, of a heritage. This is one of the difficulties of being a college administrator. We are responsible to two different worlds, in a sense. A world, the world of the establishment, the world which has been created, and which has been preserved and defended and protected and made viable over a long period of time before we came into office. And that new world which is in process of creation and which is in great part in the custody of our creative and imaginative faculty members. We have a dual responsibility to both of these worlds, and we cannot adequately fulfill our role as college administrators by denying the rights of one and overemphasizing the rights of the other. We must be cognizant of the legitimate claim of each of these worlds. The world of tradition, and what Mr. T.S. Eliot has called in his famous essay, the world of individual talent, the famous essay of 1917, Tradition and Individual Talent, in which he balances these two worlds. The heritage of the past, which is intrinsically precious and valuable, which must be preserved, which must be transmitted, which must be perfected as it is passed on to the next generation. We must also be cognizant of that new world of individual talent in the poet, in the artist, in the scientist, represented in our faculties, who have something new and valuable to contribute to that viable tradition. It's not a tradition of the past. It's not dead. It's not completed. It is in process of being perfected. And it cannot be perfected if it is killed or if it is dead. We must recognize it as a living, viable tradition. And we must see our faculty members now as the persons who currently are capable not only of understanding that tradition, but of perfecting it and extending it to a new age, better, more perfect, more complete than it was presented to them. My faculty habitually criticizes me for going overtime, ladies and gentlemen. They tell me I have no terminal facilities, and I think that I have gone beyond my limits at the present time. I will recapitulate some of the key points that I would like to leave with you as the focus of my remarks. The responsibility of the president and the administration of a college in our day of being faithful primarily to the faculty and secondarily to that larger public of several different constituencies, but that the fundamental responsibility is to the faculty. Secondly, that the freedom, the academic freedom, which a faculty member enjoys as an extension of his personal freedom as an individual citizen, enjoying freedom of speech in our society, is not an absolute freedom, but it is a freedom conditioned by the good name of the institution he represents and by the good name of those persons with whom he deals in his public statements. The freedom of a faculty member is limited, as I mentioned a few moments ago, in my opinion, by this fact, that he is not free to espouse publicly positions or tenets which in his heart, and as the result of his own research, he cannot sincerely endorse. He may not use these positions as a pedagogical gimmick, nor may he use them as a means of stimulating the interest of sleepy students. We've all been plagued with the problem of sleepy students in every generation. The professor is free to use many different pedagogical devices, but he cannot expect the university or the college to defend him publicly when he makes statements which in his own heart he cannot seriously endorse. I recognize that this seems like a potpourri of opinions, ladies and gentlemen, but I've skipped deliberately from one topic to another in the hope that I might present for your consideration at the question period those topics which are of basic importance to me and which might stimulate your questions and your interest. Thank you.
I'm indulging in no rhetoric when I say that it is a distinct pleasure and honor to have with us tonight Professor Fritz Machlup, Professor of Economics and International Finance at Princeton University, also retiring president of the national organization, the AAUP. Professor Machlup was born in Austria, received his academic training at the University of Vienna, where he received the PhD degree in 1923. He came to the United States in 1933. He has held positions at such schools as Harvard, the University of Buffalo, Johns Hopkins, and a variety of leading institutions for shorter periods about the country. He has been at Princeton since 1960. During this time and in his work as an economist, he has held many positions of trust and leadership in such organizations as the American Economic Association, the Royal Economic Society, and many others. He has also published a rather frightening number of books and articles in the field of economics. I think of him tonight, however, primarily as a representative of the American Association of University Professors. In this organization, he has made many contributions over a considerable period of time. If I were to single out one work of that is particularly noteworthy, I would say it was his idea some years ago that the AAUP conduct a self-grading salary survey. In a surprisingly short period of time, this has become the national norm. He has also, as chairman of Committee Z, which has done so much work for the economic status of the profession, submitted some of the most brilliant reports that it's been my pleasure to read. He has also served with great skill during the past year as president of the association, and he just recently delivered a presidential address on the subject of tenure that really made this meaningful to everyone who heard it and to the many who will soon read it. With those comments, Professor Moklif, welcome to Minnesota, and thank you for being with us.
Mr. Chairman, fellow panelists, ladies and gentlemen, I have now so many things learned from the previous speakers that I almost am tempted to change my concept of what I should say tonight. I might, for example, just because of the introduction, discuss the problem of publish or perish. He said I've published so terribly much that must have shown that I had suffered under anxieties that I might perish if I didn't. But none of my 23 books was written under that compulsion. I might also fear now, since my certified area of competence is in economics, that President of Princeton might not feel compelled to defend me if I now talk on political philosophy. But I hope he will. Now, the assignment which I really gave to myself is a different one. I gave myself the following assignment. I imagine to be a legislator. And having been given the task, the mandate from the legislature to make an investigation and to study the policies and practices of appointment and retention of professors at some university and to report on my findings. Now, this is quite a task. I have never been a legislator, but I'll try. I have enough imagination, so I'll try to imagine. Needless to say, not many educators could be legislators, but my point is that every legislator should be an educator. That doesn't mean that he should be a professional educator. I mean that part of his function is to educate. He has that perpetual function, to educate himself, to educate his fellow legislators, and to educate the broad public. He should not follow, democracy does not mean that he should follow the majority rule, an uneducated majority rule, but that he should educate his voters so that an educated majority rule will prevail. So in that sense, a good legislator is an educator, and I would hope that if I were then a legislator writing such a report, I would feel compelled to write a report that will have this, that will render this service to the legislature as well as to the public. Perhaps I should give examples. I would like to say, you perhaps know that poll that was once taken. Men on the street were asked whether they approved certain statements, and they were given the statements that were in the Bill of Rights. And the overwhelming majority said, oh, impossible, that's just communist propaganda. Now, in this sense, then, if you followed that majority, we would abolish the Bill of Rights. In this sense, an educator, a legislator has to educate constantly and continuously. Now, if I had to write this report, then, my first task would be, then, an educational one, to restate the purposes, principles, and safeguards of academic freedom. I shall be short, but I mention that I would try to bring home at least 4 points. One, that academic freedom is not merely an aspect of the general freedom of speech, which is mentioned in the First Amendment, but it goes much further. It goes much further because for certain professions, who live on speech, whose function it is to think and to speak, greater safeguards are needed. And such immunities are then conferred upon legislators, federal judges, and professors. They are immunities against sanctions that might be be dangerous for them if they said something or wrote or published something which is highly unpopular. The second thing that I would say is that this is not a privilege for a particular group of people, but this has the purpose of benefiting society. It is society that benefits from the discovery of new truth. And I don't have to say now to point to Galileo. He didn't benefit from the fact that he showed that the Earth was not the center of the universe. It was society that did. And the same thing could be said for many others. I could say Darwin didn't benefit from his theory of evolution, it was society that learned and benefited from all this. So we have to protect the people who innovate, who subvert old traditions and old truths. Now, the third thing which I would drive home there is that social and political progress depends very largely on subverting, again, old received conventions and convictions. And I could tell any number of things which once were considered highly subversive. I could say, as you perhaps remember, in the 19th century, it was subversive to say that the workmen could enter voluntary associations. Trade unions were outlawed. And today, no one would dream of that. Well, some people might dream, yes, nobody would really say that out loud. Or it was absolutely subversive to say that there might be an income tax to raise funds for the government. This was all subversion. Now it's orthodoxy. So what happens is that what is subversive one day is accepted the second day and becomes orthodox the third day. And these days may take a long time. And the professors have a very great function in making for this social and political progress. And if they were not protected for saying unpopular things, social and political progress would be greatly retarded. If you wish, I could add one example. There are the foreign policy of a government would get very easily into ruts, and to get out of it, it's almost impossible for them, because in the meantime, all the people have accepted these things as doctrines, as dogmas. It takes professors to say to stick some pins into these things, and usually a former professor, Senator Fulbright, has talked about the various myths that make it impossible or make it difficult for the government to revise foreign policy when it is needed. Again, it is Fulbright is a former teacher, and we teachers know how important these things are. The fourth thing that I would put into this introduction would be that what is really important is that academic freedom is infringed by any kind of punitive action whenever the disseminator of an unpopular idea must fear that his spoken, written, or printed words will bring forth recriminations of any sort, of any material sort, time spent in answering summons, time spent in replying to embarrassing questions before an investigating committee, his freedom is infringed. Now then, after this preliminary discussion, I would go to my second task and would draw really a conclusion from the last point that I made. Namely, I must make sure that my study, my study is not an attempt to intimidate. I would even say it is only a study to show, to disseminate important knowledge, but not a study attempting to make some people uncomfortable. No one should be made uncomfortable by such a study. If such a investigation puts some, embarrasses people, if it were leading to getting people to testify and to ask what their beliefs are and their convictions are, and asking administrators whether they knew that this is the conviction of this and this man, this would be the kind of investigation which I would call per se an infringement of academic freedom. So, knowing the importance of academic freedom, I would, in my report, say that surely the legislature knows that this kind of investigation is not wanted. What is wanted is a study that shows that academic freedom really prevails and it is safe at the institution that is being studied. Now, I come to a third task, and there I may have to address myself to some findings that I got from my investigation. Now, in the course of investigating, I may have come across a statement by some members of the faculty or some members of the administration that we have no communist on our faculty. Well, I would take a dim view of such a statement. I would say this statement reflects already certain anxieties that academic freedom is not safe. Because why should you come out with such a statement? I would also frown upon a statement of this sort. Surely we would never appoint a man of whom we knew that he is a communist. I would frown on that, and I would probably cite Senator Taft, who was not a radical, if you remember. Senator Taft at that time was a member of the Board of Trustees at Yale University, and he was asked whether he would favor the appointment or would permit the appointment of a communist. And he said, oh, certainly I would not object if he's becoming a professor of mathematics. Well, good, but I would go further. I would say I would not object if he became a professor of economics. And I say that as an economist. And therefore, I have to defend my very radical point of view here, and which you will see in a minute, it isn't radical at all. Perhaps I should mention, only few people know me, my fellow economists consider me a terribly dull conservative. Some even call me a reactionary. But now let me explain why I would feel that it's perfectly all right, not only all right, it would be perfectly fine to have a couple of communists in my department. Why? Three reasons I give you. The first is that I could be so much more effective, especially in explaining the disadvantages of socialist systems and the advantages of the capitalist system. My praise of capitalism, or call it not praise, by my rosy picture of capitalism, in which I believe, falls flat if I have no one to argue with. Well, of course, I could put up some straw men and fight it. That's not right. Doesn't do the real trick. But if I have a colleague who advocates communism and praises communism all the time, then I can really go to town. And I would love that. I could show my student who is right. And my students would learn a great deal from that. Secondly, I want the students to become immune. And you know, in order to get immune, you must get a bit exposed. I gave this example this afternoon to the gentlemen of the press and of TV, and I gave them this illustration. If you want to be immune against a contagious disease, you get a little shot to get a vaccine or something, and that develops your immunity. But if you never get this, then you are really not immune and you may contract the disease. What I mean is this. The man leaving college and never having been exposed to these dangerous ideas is not immune. If he then afterwards is exposed to a preacher of communism and there is no one around who would answer the contentions of Mr. Communist, then this young victim may really become a case of a severe case of communism. And I believe, therefore, since I think it is a disease, we should immunize our students, and that can be done only by exposure and not in any other way. The third thing, a reason why I would favor to have communist colleagues, and I would say these colleagues must be qualified. I mean, not just preachers of communism. They must be good economists at the same time. The third is this. I might find that in some respects my teaching of the economics of communism, of Soviet economics, has not been entirely correct. And I might, in listening to their arguments, find that I have to revise my own statement. And to make you fully understand this, let me give you the following example. What happens at the University of Moscow or at the University of Leningrad? Do they teach the economics of capitalism? Yes, they do. Indeed, they spent their entire first year in economics doing exactly that. Marxism is the economics of capitalism. And they give there a picture of how capitalism and how a free enterprise economy works, a picture which I consider completely wrong, completely fallacious. Well, I would say the academic freedom of the Soviet students of economics is really the freedom to learn is greatly restricted by the fact that they do not permit a man like myself or other American economists to offer a course there about how the American economy works. Now, they feel, oh, no, we know better how the American economy works than we do. I don't agree. So I would like to say to the people there, you and I have different opinions about how the free enterprise economy works. Why don't you allow me to offer a course, and a communist will offer a course, and your students will be exposed to both sides. They will learn how to think and how to judge. I think that's fair, isn't it? Now, if it's fair, if we think it's fair that we do that in Moscow and in Leningrad, I would think it's fair also that we do that in the United States. I would like to invite Soviet economists to present their views how the communist economy functions. And of course, I would do the same. I would also give my views how the Soviet economy functions. I think only in this fashion could we really learn a great deal about it. Now, I follow the example of President Father Shannon and rush to my next topic and would go to the fourth task of my report. And this is the relationship between academic freedom and academic responsibility. On this alone, I should like to have 1 hour, but unfortunately, I have only a few minutes left. Now, I would have to say what the responsibility is and responsibility for what. What does it comprise? What happens to one who is not responsible and how are, and so on. Too many questions to consider in a few minutes. But let me give you four different views of what academic responsibility is in its relation to freedom. The first view is that it is the counterpart, a quid pro quo. I give you freedom, and you accept certain responsibilities. Now, this is widely held. And in order to show you the logic of that, let me give you an example of something which is completely irresponsible, where no one in the room would doubt that it is irresponsible and must not be tolerated. Let's say a professor would distribute certain drugs to his class, opium, and would say they should all try it and so on. I think this would certainly be irresponsible. Nobody would doubt that. Now, does it mean I give you freedom and you accept this responsibility in exchange? Of course not. I would never allow you to do that. It's not a quid pro quo. This kind of action is out, freedom or no freedom. And hence to say, I give you freedom and you promise not to do irresponsible things is just absurd. So this idea that responsibility is the quid pro quo of freedom is illogical. The second possibility is this. There are certain things, certain irresponsibilities which should be out, and it is a practical condition to make freedom survive. In other words, the profession must undertake certain responsibilities if it wants academic freedom to survive. That is a logical point of view, which I would accept. The question is then only how to define these responsibilities. The third way of looking at responsibilities is to look at them as just a limitation of freedom. You have freedom, but there are certain limits to the freedom. Hence, I do not grant you absolute freedom. Here it stops. Difficulty is how to define these limits. A fourth view is this. Academic freedom is given to each professor. That means we will protect him. But the academic responsibility is really a collective responsibility of the faculty, that they will recommend, let's say, the removal of a man who is a fake, the removal of a man who falsifies the truth. That they, in other words, take it upon themselves to see that their profession is an honest profession and not a profession which contains people who fabricate results and falsify figures and data and so on, and know it. Now, these are various different kinds of academic, of defining the relationship between freedom and responsibility. Now, I don't think I can forgive myself if I did not answer one point that Father Shannon has made. And this is the one which I introduced jokingly or laughingly, but which I think is a very serious one. And that is the restriction of academic freedom to the area of the scholar's competence. Let me first of all say that the statement of the professors together with the college presidents in 1940, you know there's a statement of principle of 1940 where these, which was worked out in 6 years of negotiations between the Association of American Colleges, which now consists of 850 colleges, and the Association of American University Professors, which now consists of over 60,000 professors. Now, these worked out together. Now, it is quite true that there is this mention about the areas of competence, but that refers to the teaching in the classroom. And there is a separate statement about the right of a citizen outside the classroom. Now, this is an important thing, because I may wish to speak out on questions in which I am politically interested as a citizen, and my right of a citizen as a citizen should not be less than that of someone who is not a professor. And the fact that I have taught economics should not debar me from giving my views as a citizen. And this right to speak out as a citizen should not be restricted. And that was also made quite clear in this. And therefore, this right should also be defended by the president. And an additional difficulty also about areas of competence, let me say that the greatest men that have ever lived were polyhistors. That means they were great in several fields, not just in one. I don't have to go to the very old philosophers, but I mention Leibniz or I mention Newton. If you ask what did Newton chiefly do, if you count pages, well, chiefly theology. Newton's page, if you count pages, his pages on theology exceed those on physics enormously. I don't know how good he was as a theologian, but we certainly wouldn't want him to shut him up. Or take Kant. Kant was a philosopher, but he wrote a lot about law and other things. Or I mentioned now the mathematician Cournot, who wrote on economics, the philosopher Jevons, who wrote on economics, and the astronomer Newcomb, who wrote on economics. Not only wrote, but also taught about it, and so on. One more man. Einstein said the stupidest things about economics. Really, he was so naive. But he thought he knew everything, so he also said a lot about social sciences and economics. We surely wouldn't want to dismiss him as a professor of physics just because he said stupid things about economics. So let's not restrict people merely by this reference to the areas of competence, and let's not even say he acted irresponsibly. Sure, in a way he did. He should know that he didn't study economics, and therefore he should keep silent. But if he doesn't, there are enough economists there who would then say, listen, he's a great physicist. Thank you very much.